The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And good morning and welcome to this October 30th, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. We're on Stitcher. However you consume your podcast, you can find us there under Writers on Writing. And for the last couple of weeks, we have been soliciting your feedback to the show, and we have gotten really, really wonderful feedback. And we are listening. As the Fraser Crane used to say, we are listening. And so anyway, we're really encouraging listeners to write in. Let us know what you think of the show, what you want more of, what you want less of. Based on some of the feedback that we got, I just booked Louis L'Amour's son to come and talk about his lost manuscripts, some of his unpublished stuff, based on a request for more information on genre fiction. So write to us, penonfire@earthlink.net. is Barbara, penonfire@earthlink.net. You can always write to me at mariestone@gmail.com, two R's in Marie. And I am your host, Marie Stone, and we are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. I'm joined now by Aris Chanigian, and coming up in the second half, I'll be chatting with Robert Kerbeck about his new book, Malibu Burning. Robert is in a little bit of peril this morning. He's evacuating his mother from the Simi Valley fire as we speak. And so, you know, as with all live radio and the urgency of the California wildfire crisis, he is dealing with that. So fingers crossed that he will be able to join us at 9:30. But first, Aris Chanigian. His first novel, Bloodvine, was hailed by the LA Times as a strong and welcome new voice, and in subsequent novels, he has plumbed the American experience from the struggle of 1920s immigrants to the fields of California, to the neuroses and decadence of contemporary culture. His 2012 novel, This Angelic Land, set during the 1992 LA riots, was called Today's Necessary Book. Waiting for Lipschitz at Chateau Marmont was about a screenwriter who goes from riches to rags. That book spent 17 weeks on the LA Times bestseller list. He was on the show with Barbara in 2016 for that novel. You can find that podcast in our archives. Aris holds a PhD in psychology from the Claremont Graduate University and was formerly a senior professor of humanities at the Southern California Institute of Architecture, and a contributing writer to West, the LA Times Sunday magazine. In addition to his five novels, he is also the co-author of Something from Nothing. But it's his most recent, Waiting for Sophia at Shutters on the Beach, that we are going to talk about this morning. Aris, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me, Marie.
Oh, thanks for coming back on. So, Waiting for Sophia is the second in the Waiting trilogy, and it's certainly of a similar style to Waiting for Lipschitz. So it's a nameless narrator, and the novel is told kind of in one fell swoop with no chapters or breaks, sort of this breathless, perhaps martini-infused stream of consciousness kind of monologue. So were the books always conceived of as a trilogy, or sort of when and how did that idea present itself?
I think I was halfway done with Waiting for Lipschitz at Chateau Marmont when I thought, this might work as a trilogy. I wanted to look at issues in contemporary culture. The Marmont was about the decadence of Hollywood and the fate of a particular screenwriter following the 2008 economic collapse. And Waiting for Sophia is about the decadence of academy and the excesses of sexual politics. And the third volume that I'm sketching out right now is going to be about the heroin epidemic. So about halfway through Lipschitz, I had the idea for this trilogy.
And all of them sort of told with that same style of the nameless narrator and kind of the stream of consciousness inner monologue kind of style?
Yes. Obviously, play off of Waiting for Godot, Beckett's famous play.
Yeah, right.
And all of them are aiming to be just a little bit longer than a novella would be. I think Sophia comes in at 200 pages.
Right.
And, yes, they'll have the same nameless narrator and someone waiting for someone to show up. And the third volume right now is tentatively titled Waiting for Rafi. Rafi is an Armenian name. Waiting for Rafi at the Jonathan Club.
Great. All of these iconic L.A. locales. You had said
right.
in another interview that it's easier for you to write about these L.A. locales when you're living away from it. You're now in Fresno. And
correct.
Sort of that physical distance maybe kind of gives you perspective on L.A. that maybe would be harder to have if you were physically here.
Yes, I think so. It's hard to know why that distance gives you the latitude, but it just so happened to work out that way. When I moved, I was born and raised in Fresno, but I lived nearly all my life in Los Angeles in the same neighborhood. When I moved back 7 years ago, that is to Fresno, I just felt like L.A. became clearer for me, and I felt like a need to write about it. Though my third novel, This Angelic Land, was set in Los Angeles during the 1992 riot. So this would be, I guess, my third book set in Los Angeles.
Hmm. And you...
And I was in Los Angeles when I wrote This Angelic Land.
Okay. And you... So I guess we should introduce Sophia a little bit. Our nameless narrator is a professor. Sophia is a former student. I'll let you kind of set the stage for it a little bit before I ask you a couple more questions about it, but kind of take us into, who these characters are, what the center of the conflict is and kind of how you got there, who you started with, what you started with when you wrote it.
Well, the narrator, as you said, is a nameless professor. He is waiting at Shutters on the Beach for a, student of his. Who a doctoral student whom he advises, and she is introduced slowly into the book. We discover that she's quite a beauty and has a very alluring intellect. He has a crush on her, but has never acted on that. So as he waits, you're right, he has one martini, then two, and I think even three. we discover who this woman whom he is waiting for is, not just in terms of her biographical past, but in terms of his admiration and feelings for her. And this is set against his role as an advisee on a sexual harassment case at the university where he teaches.
Right.
So there's a lot of tensions right away regarding what he proposes to do with this student whom he is waiting for. And he definitely wants to proposition.
Right. And her sort of take is a different, you know, it's not the classic, I guess, stereotypical female take on sexual harassment, sexual encounters with men. She kind of takes a little bit of the opposite side. And the debates that she and her classmates have through flashbacks and whatnot are really very interesting. I kept thinking this would be such a great book club book because it would get so many... I mean, under the generalization that a lot of book clubs are all women, it would get women really talking about their own experiences, talking about, you know, where they fall on these lines. And even in the book, you know, the students are debating amongst themselves all of these Me Too gender-based, You know, it's almost as much about power as it is about sex. And all of those philosophical issues in the time frame we find ourselves in. At what point in our society did this idea come from you? Like, where were we in our culture when this idea presented itself to you? Like, were we pre-Kavanaugh hearings? Were we post-Weinstein? Where were we?
Oh, this book has been a long time in the making. I have there's a very sad backstory to this book. I had finished writing Lipschitz about 4 years ago, 5 years ago now, and I set about to write this book. So this was well before Kavanaugh.
Okay.
I saw it gathering, like a gathering storm in the distance, the Me Too movement.
Yeah.
And so I had written a draft of the book when I came to my office one morning and discovered that it had been broken into and my computer had been stolen and the two backup drives that I had left there had also been stolen with the book on it. So I had to start the book from scratch. And so that's why it's so late coming, actually.
Wow.
So I've had this book on my mind for about 5 years. Started about 5 years, well before Kavanaugh and the Me Too movement.
Okay.
And so it's ironical that when I finished it, the Me Too movement was reaching its heated pitch. And I thought this was a perfect book for our times.
Absolutely. You said you saw this kind of coming and boiling on the horizon. What was the canary in the coal mine for you?
It was the case of the, I forget her name now, the woman at Columbia who was accusing a fellow classmate of sexual assault, and she carried a mattress around with her. And I guess subsequently, that her accusations were, rebutted, and she's kind of fallen away from the narrative that she had forwarded about this classmate. But that was, to me, the canary in the coal mine. I saw that this is leading to a very different kind of take on sexuality, and it really was concerning to me as an artist because sexuality is... And its expression and its playfulness, I felt was going to be in jeopardy. And I think I was on the money.
Yeah. And it's interesting to look to college campuses in particular. I mean, I feel like the college campuses were really the if we're going to keep using the phrase canary in the coal mine for this, I mean, it's sort of a combustible environment for this, where you have a lot of, you know, young,
sure,
highly sexual people all bundled together and, you know, positions of power with professors and whatnot. And I was also wondering if when you were working on this, if not only did you need the geographic distance of space from LA, but if you also needed the distance from academia. I know you were steeped in academia mm-hmm. for a long time. And if being kind of mired in it would help you write the book, or if you needed to kind of get away from college campuses in order to get some sort of clarity on how to approach this.
Well, thank you for that question. I don't think I could have written this book if I were anywhere near an academic campus. I probably would be somehow censored or maligned or stalked. Mm-hmm. It's a fairly radical book. Right now, I think there's a fairly strong censoriousness going on, and I don't think an academic can write this book. So I'd have to be very far away from it, and writing from some office in Fresno, where I can't be located. The book has gotten a lot of resistance, even well before, you know, its release.
It's funny you should say that, because I was like, the book, to let our listeners know, doesn't even come out until Friday. So Friday is the pub date. And I was like, I just can't wait to hear what you hear back on the book, because, yeah, it's really going to get people talking for sure. And so the break-in in your office had nothing to do with the content of the book. That was just a random happenstance event? Or
yes.
Okay. So you don't think anybody, you know, targeted this or knew you were working on it? Okay.
No.
Okay. Did it change your mind about anything? Like, I do feel like writers come through some sort of process of working through all of the arguments. And, you know, there were a lot of debates and whatnot in the book amongst the graduate students themselves. And I always wonder if in the process of writing all of that, a writer changes his or her mind about anything, any preconceived notions that they went into the book with.
Yes, the book includes actual studies on sexual harassment that are debated in the course of a classroom graduate study seminar, undergraduate seminar.
Right.
And so I'm trained as a research psychologist. So I'm very happy to read studies that are often quoted.
Right.
And so I became actually more convinced of my hunch about sexual politics and the excesses of the Me Too movement as I began to read the studies and discovered what the data actually showed. So I guess it became more alarming to me about how these studies were being used and portrayed in the media to drum up what I would only call hysteria about sexual assaults and harassment on college campuses.
It's so interesting sitting here at UCI when the head of the MFA program here resigned a year ago, I think exactly a year ago, under, you know, similar circumstances. And anyway, I mean, it's just so relevant. And it's interesting to me that you started this book so long ago and it just keeps coming and roiling out and unfolding in all of these different origamic ways. It's a prescient and timely and everything else book. It's just fascinating. I'm curious about writing Sophia and if she was a character. Which of the characters in here gave you the most difficulty in fleshing out, and if the characters perhaps who are more distant from you may have even been easier for you to write, or if it were the people that you identified with that gave you the most trouble. Just talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of who was the biggest challenge for you?
Definitely Sophia.
Yeah.
I wanted to write from the perspective of a strong, very strong, almost archetypal, I think you'd agree, female character.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a man. she is a very intelligent, beautiful woman. I don't know if I'm going to ruin it for the listeners to give what her occupation is. Do you think I should go ahead and mention that?
Do you? I think I read it before I read it in the book, so I think it's out there, but
okay.
Yeah, it's interesting. So they might as well.
So she likes a number of women. Put herself through school as a escort, sexual escort. And that was very difficult to write.
Yeah.
I had to do a lot of research. I read what books I could. But she came alive to me when I decided that she would also be a very religious person. And somehow her sense of the sacred which I definitely share, became more important than how she made her way through school financially.
Yeah.
The book is largely about grace and forgiveness and the power of sexuality to heal and the deep archetypal mechanisms that are at play between men and women that seem to me to have been shoved out of the conversation in contemporary culture.
Yeah, and I, you know, it's just so interesting to consider whether this is a kind of a uniquely American situation. She hails from Poland, and they had kind of had their own puritanical take on sexuality, and you know, but I always wonder, like, if this was set in France or something, or England, would it work? Like, do they have the? I guess England has similar conversations, but. It does seem like America is just kind of a uniquely puritanical, litigious, either that's our general culture or that's something we're kind of going through, but it feels, you know, kind of a uniquely American experience. I don't know, given the breadth of your, worldly experience, if you feel that way too, or.
Yeah, I think the puritanical, strain always rears its head in American culture. It's odd that it should be rearing its head from the left at this time in history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know if other countries share it as much as we do. I haven't lived abroad enough to really answer that question. But I think you are right that these are American books. The Waiting For trilogies are meant to plumb the American experience and to leave some kind of narrative document behind that can illuminate where we stood at this time in history.
Yeah. As I'm thinking about it, I'm like, you need way more than a trilogy. Like, you need one on gun, you know, our gun issue. You need one on our, you know, oh God, there's
sure.
So many healthcare issues. You really could have a whole long series going on here with the American experience right
now. Yeah, they're short books, but they're not easy to write.
No. Well, and they're really not even easy to read. I mean, they're just packed with so many different ideas. And, you know, I found myself stopping every kind of 5 to 6 pages and redigesting kind of what I thought about the characters and what I thought about life and what I thought about the situation. And, you know, they're very challenging. And, hence why I think they would just be the most fantastic book club books because, God, there's just so much to talk about with them.
They're also very funny.
Oh yeah, they are. You're right. Yes, I should mention that they are. They are very funny. Lipschitz might have been. Do you think it was even more funny than Sophia?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Lipschitz was just hilarious to write. but this professor is ranting against academia. He is. You know, he's a full-time professor. And in fact, the novel starts with a rant against the administration's treatment of adjunct professors.
Right.
And the entire decadence and hypocrisy of academia is central to his thought process. He is... You know, the listeners should know he is himself accused of sexual harassment and is being pushed out of the school into early retirement.
Right. You would never want to go into academia after reading this book, I would have to say. It paints a very complicated picture. I mean, you know, the lines that professors have to walk because you do develop such an intimacy with your students typically, especially at these small schools and particularly in graduate programs, you do have, you know, you spend a lot of time together. You have all of these, you know, kind of intimate discussions.
True.
It's a quagmire, man. That's a rough relationship.
Well, it is a quagmire, and I think the novels help us look into the gray areas of these what seem to be cut and dry issues. And I don't think that many novelists are taking those kind of chances these days.
Correct. No, I agree with you. This was definitely one of the more challenging and, challenging books that I've come across in that regard in a very long time, which was really fun, which was, you know. We're drawing down on our time, but I also wanted to ask you about, so you have never had an agent for any of these five books. Is that true?
I've never had an agent.
Wow. Okay.
I've never had a publisher.
Right.
No one's been very interested in my writing, in terms of its, economic potential, I suppose. Hmm. Yeah, I may be one of the only writers in America who's done five books and, you know, done well with them.
Yeah.
Particularly I've had good critical attention. Might be the only writer in America at that level who does not even have an agent.
That's crazy. And you were with Rare Bird for Malmont, and now you are with Regent Press for this. So Rare Bird did not want to pick up the trilogy, or what happened? I mean, I don't want to pick scabs here, but I'm just curious about the process.
Well, the book is not an easy one for publishers at this time to take on.
Yeah.
Let's leave it at that.
Okay. That's fair. It's just a really interesting. I hope people read these as we'll have to wait a while if you want to read them all as a trilogy. But I hope people, you know, kind of see the books. It's interesting to see them in conversation with each other and kind of the larger conversation about the American experience, as you say, and the LA experience. I think is really a great way to read them. Do you have last minute advice, especially on the editing process? Like, I was kind of wondering if you wrote this kind of in one fell stream. It comes out as sort of a stream of consciousness swoop. And I was wondering if that was how it was written, and then how you go about dealing with the editing in the aftermath.
Well, I put, with this trilogy, I put a kind of challenge to myself as a writer to write a shortish book with that possesses its own eternal energy that doesn't require the props of traditional novels. So, you know, it's hard to keep a book going without any breaks.
Yeah, right.
You know, but I think it does. I've had people tell me that it's just kind of moves along with kind of locomotive force.
Yes.
So I write, but the editing process, going back and stitching it together and making it, you know, what I hope to be seamless, is a lot of work.
Yeah. What was the time period of
transition breaks in time that have to be stitched together and made, you know, effortless and all that, all the rest.
Right. What was the full time frame on this? I know you lost it and then you had to regain it, but what was kind of the beginning to end time frame of writing it?
Well, probably from the time I started, it was about to the publication about 5 years.
Okay.
But I, for about a year, I was so depressed I couldn't pick it up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those hellish stories. I mean, to actually have your novel stolen.
Yeah.
So it was about 2 years of the writing of this book.
Do you feel like having it stolen gave you, you know, how they say that if you have to start over, the best bits are kept in your head and Maybe it's a... Do you see any gift in that at all? This is purely bad.
People told me I would, you know, brighter friends, and they were right.
Yeah.
Yes, it's exactly as you said. I tried to recreate the book, and then I found out that the book had to be pushed well beyond, you know, what I had previously imagined. And I think it ended up being a better book.
Yeah.
I'm glad I stuck with it, but it was very difficult. The hardest book I've ever had to write.
I would imagine. Well, it was worth the wait. Waiting for Sophia is available this Friday, November 1st. It's published by Regent Press, and you can find more about Eris online. You have a website, which is a good website. It's yourname.com, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And I don't know if anybody in the listening audience lives in Los Angeles or wants to make a trip out, but I'm going to have my launch in Los Angeles at Book Soup on December 2nd.
Oh, fantastic.
At 7 p.m.
Fantastic. I will include that information in the podcast, which will be up in a couple of days. So that's great. That's great. Eris,
well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. And this was a great pleasure. Congratulations on the on the arduous task of getting this book out there. It was absolutely worth it. Worth the wait for all of us. Congratulations.
It was delightful to talk to you today.
To you. We're going to take a very short break. Robert Kerbeck will be with me for the second half hour talking about his book, Malibu Burning, a timely and tragic discussion of California's wildfire crisis happening as we speak. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We'll be right back.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We are streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, however you consume your podcast. We are under Writers on Writing. I am your host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Robert Kerbeck is an award-winning actor and writer whose essays and short stories have been adapted to film and theater. He is the founder of the Malibu Writers Circle and a three-time nominee for the Pushcart Prize. A lifelong member of the Actors Studio, Robert has worked extensively in theater, film, and television, appearing in lead roles in major shows and earning several awards. His book, Malibu Burning, is the real story behind LA's most devastating wildfire, a fire that Robert himself fought and ultimately saved his own home last year. It is out and available this Friday, November 1st. Robert, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
What a morning to be talking to each other. I was telling the listeners in the first half hour that your mother is being evacuated as we speak from the Simi Valley fire. So it's all just history repeating. I am so, so sorry to hear that.
Oh, well, thank you. She's stuck in traffic, which is unfortunately a very common thing with these fires. The roads get overloaded very quickly. Her first instinct was to come to us. My brother lives in the San Fernando Valley, and my hometown is Philadelphia. My mother's from Philadelphia, and so she still doesn't quite understand that these winds blow in a very specific direction, and Malibu is directly downwind of her home. So I had to tell my mom, probably not the best idea to come to Malibu because we may be seeing that fire here in 8 to 12 to 16 hours if things don't change.
I'm so sorry. Yikes. So, full disclosure, you and I met at a summer workshop at Tin House in 2016. So we were Facebook friends during the Woolsey fire last year, and I followed your story, or as much of your story as you shared on Facebook in real time last year. And, you know, I mean, every time at this year, it's just harrowing and tragic and you know, history repeating, as we said.
And getting worse. I mean, I think that's the thing that's the most frightening is that, you know, wildfires, you know, it's not a new thing to California, but wildfires this frequently and with the devastating results that have occurred with the last in the last 2 years. I mean, we've had four of the worst 10 fires in California history in the last 2 years. And that's not counting the fires that the fire we have today, the Easy Fire. So it really is, I think, a pretty clear sign of climate change and the effects that that's having on our planet. And unfortunately, I think we Californians now are going to be living with that, and I fear that California is a bit like the canary in the coal mine, and in another year or so, we may be seeing these types of fires in other places that maybe haven't had the experience with wildfire that California has. So I think other western states may be seeing some of these fires in the near future. I hope I'm wrong, but, I mean, we're having fires break out every day. In the last 2 weeks, I think we've had five.
Right.
So it really is unprecedented, the number of fires and how extreme these fires are. And obviously the Woolsey Fire was the worst fire in Los Angeles history, and it happened at the same time as the Camp Fire up north in Paradise, which was the worst fire in California history. I mean, those two fires happened simultaneously. And I do want to say one thing quickly. You were kind and said that I fought the fire and saved my home, but really my wife did most of the heavy lifting and firefighting. So I got to get that out there. She really was the one, if we were a fire strike team, she was the captain. She was the one operating the hose. You know, we had, when we moved into our home in 2000, again, like I said, I'm from Philadelphia, and I didn't know anything about fires or fighting fires, never thought about fighting a fire, but we had a friend when we first moved in, and he said, you know, you've got to get equipment to be prepared to fight a fire, because when these fires happen, they happen so quickly, the fire department is often overwhelmed, and they just can't get to, forget about most places. A lot of times they can't get to any places. And that's kind of what happened with the Woolsey Fire. They were overwhelmed. The winds were so strong that power poles were literally taken down. Most roads were blocked. And so in our neighborhood, there were no fire engines. There were no firefighters. There were no helicopters. There were no planes. So, you know, locals called it the yo-yo fire, for you're on your own. Mm. And so we had some basic firefighting equipment and gear. And between my wife and my teenage son and I, we operated it, and we sprayed our house with this fire retardant Phos-Check. And we're pretty sure that's what saved our house, because we have a Victorian home. It's all wood. If any home should have burned in my neighborhood, it was our home. And our home is a wasteland. We lost about 180 out of 275 homes, 17 of 19 on my street. It was obviously quite intense. And living here today, you know, it's, you know, you're living in a natural disaster area, which is, of course, something that I never considered that was where I was going to live. You know, you think of Malibu and you think of this incredibly beautiful place, and I have to tell you, if you come to my neighborhood, it's not that beautiful anymore. My wife and I were talking about the other day, which is, you know, do we even want to continue to live here? Because not only do you have all these destroyed homes, but now you have this, constant threat of fire and smoke in the air all the time, which the smoke is toxic. It's usually, you know, the remains of people's homes floating through the air that you're now breathing in. So it's a challenge. It's quite a challenge. And I think there are things that California can do and that homeowners can do to mitigate this. And I'm happy to talk about that if you're interested.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
I think one of the things is, you know, everybody has to do a little bit better, right? And so you start with, you know, me, you know, and the homeowner, you know. And so, you know, one of the big things that homeowners can do is prepare their homes. And some of the things are actually quite simple and inexpensive. You know, usually the two ways homes burn down is, the first way is embers get inside the home and burn the home from the inside out. And, of course, the other way is something outside the home catches and then sets the home on fire. It's not that often that it's the actual home that catches on fire, because most homes, if the home has been built somewhat recently, you know, the roofing materials are fire retardant, the paint has some fire retardant elements. And so one of the least expensive things you can do is make sure that all of your vents have ember-resistant screens, mesh screens, that basically prevent embers from getting inside your home. So that's the first thing, and I cannot believe that Los Angeles County and the city of Malibu are not requiring homeowners to have these vents, because it it's a really simple step. It's inexpensive, and that's something I've been pushing for, and I'm going to continue to push for, because, like I said, it's a really low-cost way to prevent embers from getting inside your home. And then, of course, then when we look at the outside of the home, we look at flammable materials, and flammable materials are flammable trees. In my neighborhood in Malibu and in much of Southern California, we have a lot of invasive trees that aren't even supposed to be here that are extremely flammable, like eucalyptus trees. Pine trees are another extremely flammable tree. Palm trees, a lot of people don't know, they're beautiful. They sing California, extremely flammable. Mm. And when these trees catch, and this is what I saw when I fought the fire, not only do they catch on fire, but the embers fly. And right now, outside of my little tool shed where I write, there are 50-mile-an-hour winds, 60-mile-an-hour winds. And so you can imagine an ember catches on fire and the wind takes it, and you just don't know how far that ember can travel. When I did one of my interviews for the book, I interviewed the deputy fire chief for L.A. County, and he said that embers from a eucalyptus tree can travel 25 miles.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's one of the things, is that, and of course, that's an extreme, situation. But, if I were in charge, I would eliminate all pine and eucalyptus trees. Maybe I'd keep a few palm trees around because they do sing California. But so I think that if you really are serious about protecting your home, these are things you can do. No wood mulch, no wood fencing. Don't have wood piles near your house, because remember, a lot of times these fires break out, you might not be home, you might be at work, you might be on vacation. My wife now doesn't want to go on vacation during these Santa Ana wind seasons, which unfortunately, again, as a result of global warming, the fire season with these Santa Ana winds is now basically September to March. It's half the year, when it used to just be a few months.
Right, right. And you also had some sort of retardant, you said it earlier in the show, and suddenly it's just escaping my head, but something that you...
Sure, the Phos-Check.
The Phos-Check, right.
Yeah.
Is that something that you can just buy and have around the house?
Now you have to have a way to apply it to your home, but they have, devices that you can, some of them you can even use a garden hose to apply it. I mean, we had a fire pump, which is basically just like a lawnmower pump. And again, a fire pump is not especially expensive. I mean, you can get one for a few hundred dollars. You put some gas in it and you pull the cord and it starts and you have a hose. And you can spray water and you can spray Phos-Check onto your house. And that's what we did.
And you had a swimming pool, so you got some of the water from the...
Well, we didn't know. We didn't have a swimming pool. We had a hot tub.
We had a hot tub.
And one of the things about fires, and these are things I've learned from longtime Malibu locals who had fought many fires. They were very kind and told me some of these things and showed me the gear to get. And then also from all the interviews, I did over 200 interviews for this book, I learned so much about fire preparation and fire safety. And let me be clear, I'm not advising people to stay and fight fires. That is a serious decision with potentially grave consequences. But I will also say that people are going to stay. So if people are going to stay and if people feel so inclined, then I feel like they at least need to make sure they have the proper gear and that they get some proper training, because otherwise you're really not doing yourself any favors, because, staying and fighting a fire is not for the faint of heart.
Right, right. Well, let's turn our attention to the book for a little bit. You
sure.
You wrote an essay for, I believe, the LA Times, was it? In the op-ed section of the LA Times, and then from that sprung the manuscript. Talk a little bit about that decision to go from, what the ground the essay covered, and then at what point you decided, I really need to expand this and into a full-length manuscript.
Yeah, sure. So I think it was the Monday after the fire. The fire started on a Thursday, hit Malibu on a Friday, and we fought the fire. We sprayed our house with Phos-Check, and then we got out of Dodge, and we went to my mother's house in Thousand Oaks, where, of course, now my mother's been evacuated from that home. So, and we were there, and on the Monday morning, I got an email from the New York Times, and they said, hey, we know about you and your writers group, and we're looking for somebody who's there in Malibu and might know a good story or about the fire. And I said, well, funny you should ask, because, you know, we just fought to save our house. And so I started writing the piece for the Times, for the New York Times, and they kind of struggled to get a little bit of it. And I had a great interaction with the editor, and eventually they just didn't see the story the way I saw the story. And I sent it over to the LA Times, and they took it literally within 5 seconds. And I think that's kind of shows that, you know, wildfires really are a California thing, and you kind of have to be a Californian to understand what it's like with the winds and the noise and the sound and the fury. And I think sometimes people on the East Coast, they don't quite get it, and they also don't get the coverage of the fires. I was really shocked at how many, because, again, I'm from Philadelphia. I lived in New York for 7 years as an actor and have a ton of friends on the East Coast. And I was really surprised when they would tell me they really loved the posting I was doing on Facebook, because they were saying there was no coverage or very little coverage of the fire on the East Coast. And I was really surprised by that. So the LA Times did publish that essay, and then shortly thereafter, a publisher reached out and asked me if I'd be interested in writing a book, and I really had no idea how to write a book on this, because our story, my wife and my son, I mean, it was an interesting essay, I think, and it was certainly powerful and poignant, but that was just one experience. And I began to realize, like, for me to write a book on the fire, I was going to have to interview people and get their stories, and that was something I had never done. I never considered doing it, I started doing that and, reaching out to friends. And to be quite frank, I was not very good at it at first. I do like people. I am good with people. I enjoy interacting with people. And so that part of it was, I began to actually enjoy it, but I kind of didn't understand how to, you know, write this book and how to handle these interviews. And then the breakthrough for me was, and I know you're a big fan of the short story, and I'm a big fan of the short story, and I realized that I had to write each interview, each story, like it was a short story.
Yeah.
And as soon as I had that thought, I was like, oh, my gosh, these are short stories. Like, I'm going to tell all these different stories of all these different perspectives during the fire. People who fought the fire and saved entire neighborhoods. People who lost their home and everything they ever had. Firefighters fighting to save neighborhoods. Failures of bureaucracies, Southern California Edison looking like they've started another fire, the fire starting on the site of a secret nuclear meltdown, and the question, and that site has never been cleaned up. That's the Santa Susana Field Laboratory in Simi Valley, and I have a feeling most of your California listeners will have some knowledge of that, but most other people don't know that in 1959 there was this secret nuclear meltdown. The public was never told. 20 years later, a professor, Dan Hirsch, who I interviewed for the book, he and his UCLA students discovered papers, and they found out about this meltdown. And the site has never been cleaned up to this day, and the Woolsey Fire started on that site.
Unbelievable.
And then the question becomes, because there was all this vegetation that had grown on this site over the many, many years it's abandoned, the question is were radioactive materials, which don't go away in our lifetimes, were they now in the brush and in the soil that was being blown by the 70-mile-an-hour winds during the Woolsey Fire? And unfortunately, people I interviewed, including Professor Hirsch, said yes, sadly, yes. And so radioactive materials that were confined on one 3,000-acre site have now been dispersed to the greater Los Angeles area. Which is one of the tragedies, which is another one of the tragedies of this fire. It's like, not only is a fire bad enough, not only is it bad enough breathing the toxic soot and ash from people's homes, because remember, these flames, they melt everything in the home. I mean, the only thing that survives in most cases is the chimney. So refrigerators are melted, you know, all the building materials and paint and whatever you had in your garage melted, stereo equipment melted, and then all of those particles are now in the air and you're breathing those in. And then to add radioactive materials potentially, you know, on top of that, cesium, strontium, plutonium-239, it's pretty frightening. And that was a discovery that I made in writing the book that was shocking. And Los Angeles Magazine is running an excerpt from the book in an upcoming issue, and that's the excerpt they're running about the Santa Susana Field Laboratory.
Yeah, none of this stuff is talked about. I hadn't heard any of those stories elsewhere about the fires. I mean, it's just, you know, once the fire is put out and contained, they move on, I guess, to the next one. And there really is no discussion of the aftermath and you know, what the lingering damage of these fires is. It's really, this book
is
so amazing.
And you know, and there's so many levels to it. And I think, you know, one of the things I hope that my book does is it takes you inside a community and what a wildfire does to a community. And if, tragically, we're going to have more and more wildfires, there are going to be more and more communities affected. And so what I'm hoping is some people can read this book and go, okay, boy, I need to cut down some of my foliage because it's not only it's going to help me, it's going to help my neighbor, right? And one of the things that happens in these situations is one home catches, and it makes it much more likely that the home next door is going to catch. And then if those two homes catch, it makes it much more likely that the rest of the homes on the street are going to catch. And so it's really important as a community that we all do the best we can to make our homes fire safe, because it's not just good for our home, it's good for all the homes around us.
Right, right. I'm so impressed with the speed in which you wrote this. I mean, that's a tremendous amount of interviewing, synthesizing, writing to do. The fire, I mean, I had to look back and I was like, wait, this fire was a year ago, right? And the book is out now.
Yeah.
Well, I assume that's very
funny. The original publisher wanted to publish it in the fall of 2020. And I said to my wife this morning, I'm like, boy, you know what? I'm glad that I said no to that.
Yeah.
As you know, the literary world, as wonderful as it is and as fantastic as it is, it does move slowly, right? Mm-hmm. And so the idea of publishing a book in 6 months or 7 months was just, you know, quite a challenge for a New York publishing house. And I just didn't want to wait. I just felt this story was too important. I felt like there were going to be more fires. I didn't want, you know, I wanted to get information out there so people could understand that, you know, they needed to prep their homes. And maybe if they, like I said, if they feel inclined, if they're, you know, they want to, you know, stay and defend their home or at least spray it with Phos-Check and then hit the road, that they have some tools and they have some knowledge about how to do that, you know. And I also wanted to tell some of the stories so that people understood, you know, the loss involved. You know, I had this one chapter, and it's about a friend of my son's who lost the only 17-year-old young woman who lost the only bedroom she'd ever had. You know, she was born in that house, like my son was born in my house, and you know, the morning of the fire, they were, you know, they were you know, they got up at 3 a.m. And they, you know, left and, you know, took, you know, a bag with some clothes, and that was it. And so everything she had was gone, you know. And as you can imagine, as a young person, the room you had, you know, that room was so important to you, you know, whether it was your posters or your paintings or your drawings or your writing or your books or your clothes, you know, or your music, all of it gone. And it was really striking to interview someone like that, because I interviewed her kind of shortly after the fire, and she was really still in shock. Even a couple of months after the fire, she said a couple of things that really broke my heart, you know, because, you know, to be someone so young and to go through that, you know, it's a real trauma, you know, it's a real trauma, and I hope that fewer people have to go through it, and it seems like it's the opposite. It seems like more people are having to go through it.
Right, right. And it's a community that we associate with a lot of movie stars. There are a lot of famous people's names who show up in this book, but also a community of very, you know, normal, I don't know what the word normal, but, you know, very middle class, upper middle class teachers, you know, everyday people that watching that community bond together and help each other out. And it didn't matter if you were Leonardo DiCaprio or somebody, you know, I mean, it was just a community effort. I guess if something good came out of the, it seemed like that bonding of community was one of the positive parts of it, I suppose.
It's been incredible. The community has been so supportive of the book. Not one person that I asked for an interview said no, including, like you said, some pretty major celebrities. And when I started writing the book, one of the things that was really important to me was to show, you know, we have this image of Malibu, and I understand it, but it's really not accurate. Malibu, and this is funny, and most of your listeners may not even know this, you know, nobody wanted to live in Malibu. Nobody wanted to live there in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. It was too far from work. It was too far for people to commute to the jobs, you know, and the There were no jobs in Malibu then. There are no jobs in Malibu now. And so you had to commute to Los Angeles, which was very far. And so the only people that came out here were people that were coming out here because the land was cheap. And they were firefighters, they were police officers, sheriffs, and teachers. Those were like the three big groups, and blue-collar workers. Those were the people that bought here in the 60s and 70s and 80s when Malibu was the sticks. And other than a few, like, you know, music legends that didn't have a regular commute, there was nobody out here except for those people. And so a lot of times people are shocked to find out, you know, in my book that so many of these people, you know, were blue-collar types. And sadly, those are a lot of the people that lost their homes in the fire, and many of them were older, and a lot of them were underinsured. And, you know, again, another tragedy is, you know, not only do you lose your home, but then the question is can you even rebuild the home? And even if you did have enough insurance to rebuild the home, I'm telling you right now, the rebuilding process is a long, difficult, and stressful process. And even though the city and the county is trying to make it easier for fire victims, it is a long, difficult, and stressful process, which is another reason for homeowners to really do the best they can to prep their home in advance, to give their home a chance to survive. Because I'm telling you, you know, not only do you not want your home to burn down, but you know, rebuilding it. You know, I call it the myth of it's just stuff, right? There's a lot of talk. Hey, you know, just evacuate. It's just stuff. You can replace it. Blah blah blah. And again, you know, it doesn't mean you don't evacuate. Yes, you evacuate, but the idea that it's easy to get that stuff back and to rebuild your home, that's not true. And so that's another reason for homeowners to be really proactive in protecting their home.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, we're out of time, and there's so much more to talk about. But we'll have to do this again next year.
Thank you so much for having me. And I just hope, I hope somebody, a few people can see something in my book and maybe take some positive action to protect their home, protect their neighborhood, so that... you know, they don't have to go through what, unfortunately, you know, most of my community went through in the Woolsey Fire.
Yeah. Are you doing any events in L.A. for the book promotion?
Yes. As a matter of fact, there are a ton of events. And again, people have been so wonderful to host me. There's this phenomenal restaurant, The Old Place, which is hosting an event on November 8th. The Malibu Racquet Club's hosting an event on November 9th, and these events are all up on my website, robertkerbeck.com. Unless they're noted on my website, they're all open to the public, and they're free. They're really about community, and so I hope, you know, some of your listeners come out, and if they do, please come and say hi. And, you know, there are going to be a bunch of events at, you know, bookstores, Barnes & Noble Ventura, Barnes & Noble Calabasas, Barnes & Noble Thousand Oaks, but they're all on my website, and I'm just grateful for your time, because this is a really important issue, and unfortunately it's not going away.
Absolutely. And we're going to put your website up with the podcast, which will be up in a couple of days. So, check Robert out there. And good luck.
And you too. I mean, you know, that's the other thing is the fires are spreading to areas that normally in California didn't see fires.
Well, yeah, I mean, we live in Laguna Beach, and Laguna burned in 93. We just celebrated that anniversary 2 days ago, that the Laguna Beach fire was just, devastating and not quite that devastating.
I remember that fire. I had just moved to California, and I remember that fire.
Yeah. No, it's everywhere. I mean, it's definitely a statewide problem, so it's timely and important information, and thank you for the book. It's really... insightful. There's a lot of shocking material in there, and it's good for everybody to read inside and outside California, because it's coming for all of us one way or another. The global climate change is coming for all of us, however it manifests itself, and we got to be prepared. So thank you so much, and congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks. All right. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.